Kickstarter is the website where average folks pledge investment in scrappy little startups, $10 or $20 at a time. But these days, it's also attracting the attention of big money venture capitalists looking for the next billion-dollar company. Here's Aarti Shahani.
Most of the projects on Kickstarter are quirky, small, artisanal, like the glow-in-the-dark dog collar. But in one small corner of the online bazaar, the projects are about the numbers.
So if you pledge $69, you're essentially pre-ordering a LifeX smart bulb.
The company LifeX made a Kickstarter video to sell light bulbs that'll blink when you get a text. Founder Phil Boshua says it's nice to create nice things, but
when you know that there's customers there, it certainly helps.
Form Labs hopped online to sell a 3D printer and prove that designers as a class want one.
And I don't mean a few designers, I mean a few hundred thousand designers, a million designers.
Formlabs marketing director Sam Jacoby says online sales are a way to show you've got customers.
Who's going to buy your product? How are you going to make money? Who's interested? When you start your company with something like Kickstarter, that question is put on its head.
And the real money rolls in. After raising over $1 million online, LifeX made a killing with professional investors.
$2.1 million just after Kickstarter. About 8 to 9 months later, we raised another $2.5 million.
Not bad. But Formlabs did even better.
Close to $20 million in Series A financing.
As Kickstarter grows up, its language is changing from backers and creators to customers and startups, pre-orders and mass adoption.
You subscribe to the campaign, generally most of them will reach out right away, especially when they realize that I'm an investor.
Venture capitalist Brad Feld is with the Foundry Group, and he reads off a long list of Kickstarters that he supported.
Twine, NinjaBlocks, Pebble, the NeuroDreamer folks.
Feld and other venture capitalists visit the site weekly. They're looking for hardware, the physical stuff that can cost a lot of money to build. When they see that something's selling, they put in, say, $100, like dangling a little bait. And so begins the much longer process of closed-door negotiations that could lead to them taking an ownership stake in the startup. This created a bit of uproar recently. A hardware project called Oculus VR was an online hit. Venture capitalists swooped in. Then the company got bought for $2 billion by Facebook. So while crowdfunding backers got some 3D game goggles that are a bit obsolete, venture capitalists like Nabil Hyatt with Spark Capital cashed in.
We made a very healthy return that we really don't, like, publicly disclose it.
The implication was never there that I was going to be providing a seed round for a company that would eventually sell for billions of dollars.
Joel Johnson is a crowdfunding backer who's angry. He says this new venture capital activity is changing crowdfunding. Kickstarter was supposed to be an alternative to the marketplace. Now it's becoming the marketplace with traditional companies.
Now they can just use Kickstarter as a pre-sale mechanism to test their idea before they ever have to spend a dime of their own money.
In 2012, Kickstarter issued a strongly worded statement. Quote, Kickstarter is not a store, and no one should feel otherwise. Today, founder Yancey Strickler is striking a different tone. I called to ask him, what is the difference between a customer and a backer?
Well, I think in some ways that difference is up to the creator.
Though there is one stark difference. Customers often buy products from total strangers. In crowdfunding, backers interact directly with the maker.
And by virtue of that, a backer has, I think, more of an emotional relationship than a customer does.
And venture capitalists agree. Kickstarter has helped create an emotional bond that can serve many interests. For NPR News, I'm Aarti Shahani in San Francisco.
Now for a crowdfunding campaign that is definitely not about the next big thing. The story starts back in 1978. That's when a spacecraft called ISEE-3, International Sun-Earth Explorer No. 3, went into space orbiting around a point between the Earth and the Sun. That's called a halo orbit. Its job was to measure what we now call space weather. Well, then years later, through some NASA wizardry, it was moved. It was renamed ICE, International Cometary Explorer. And in 1985, it became the first spacecraft to fly past a comet, confirming that comets are basically big, dirty snowballs. Well, now, long story short, ICE has been little used since the 1990s. There's been only intermittent communication with it for decades, and NASA does not intend to spend any more money on it. Well, enter a couple of former NASA guys and the crowdfunding site Rocket Hub, where they are trying to raise cash to bring ICE back to life for its original purposes. Former NASA employee Keith Cowing is here to explain. Hiya.
Hi.
NASA has basically given its blessing to you to revive one of its satellites. How's that?
Well, they haven't said no, and they said, yeah, we'll help. But they're sort of in a predicament here where they do have budget issues, which are real. And we just saw this opportunity to grab something that might still work and with a little hackery and MacGyvery, bring it back to life.
And what's the point of doing that?
Well, A, because we can, B, because it still works, and C, can actually do something useful. And our slogan is, make me do science again.
But this is a long shot, I gather. One blogger back in February wrote that it just wasn't possible to reestablish communications. You disagree with that?
I absolutely disagree. They also said that the radio telescope dish that we used to listen to it at Morehead State couldn't hear it. Well, we keep hearing it every day. We'll know if we can't do it if we try to do it.
And do you have all of the manuals and all of the instructions for working with this late 70s vintage craft?
We are reassembling that collection. We've got a good start. We've talked to a lot of guys in their 70s and 80s who say that, you know, my wife said I have to get rid of this stuff after 30 or 40 years, and we're happy to take it.
I gather that you are trying to raise $125,000, which to my ear, for anything connected with NASA or a satellite, sounds ridiculously little.
Yeah, and we actually thought maybe we were asking a little bit too much, but we did the math, and that's what we need.
To do what? What do you do with $125,000?
Well, first of all, we need to buy some transmitters that we have to hang off some radio telescopes, so that's real money. We have to get a couple of guys to stop what they're doing to do some recreation of the hardware that no longer exists. And, of course, there's a fee for the crowdfunding, but at the end of the day, it's pretty bare bones.
How far are you towards that goal?
Well, we have guys working on the software radio right now. We've assembled documents. We've got people rebuilding a lot of the command systems that were used.
But you need $125,000. How much has been pledged so far?
As we speak, it's about $52,000.
Almost halfway there.
Yes, sir.
Now, when I asked you what's the point of this is, your first answer was you want to do it because you can do it. But to somebody who's not part of the team, what's the benefit of getting this spacecraft communicating again?
Well, after you go from because we can, the spacecraft probably does have a number of its original instruments still in operation. And NASA said, well, you know, we can't afford this, but if you guys get that back into the orbit that it was in and it can start sending data again, that data has usefulness.
Given that you say this 1978 satellite doesn't deserve to be declared junk just yet.
Oh, heavens no. It's like finding something in your garage, you dust it off and you plug it in and it works. And then your wife says, well, where are you going to put it? And say, well, how about in the spare bedroom?
Although sometimes you say, well, where are the records to play on that thing that's been in the garage all day?
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, when would it naturally die? I mean, does it have another 30 years in it?
Well, you know, the thing has had its transmitter on nonstop since 1978. It's like the Voyagers, which left Earth about the same time. And they're a little hard of hearing, but they've left our solar system and they're still working. So odds are if it's on, if it's been working this long, it'll continue working for quite some time.
Well, Keith Cowing, good luck with it.
Thank you, sir.
Astrobiologist and former NASA employee Keith Cowing, now editor of the blog NASA Watch, speaking about his effort to reestablish contact with a dormant satellite.
We wrap up All Tech with one more retro moment, an anniversary. 20 years ago today, staffers at NPR received a paper memo. Remember those? The first line read, Internet is coming to NPR. That was punctuated with an exclamation point.
The 1994 memo cites the most immediate and tangible change, email. It would replace our old fax mail system. Sign up for 1 hour of training. Or, if you do not want to use Internet, the memo says, simply do nothing.
You can read that paper memo on the internet at nparchives.tumblr.com.